The Untold Civil War is back at the movies, and tonight, Gettysburg. Yes, this is a review many have requested. A daunting task indeed, but here it is. Now first, thank you to my patrons on Patreon and my sponsors. It's their support that keeps this podcast on the air. One of those sponsors happens to be Civil War Trails. Civil War Trails was just in Goldsboro, North Carolina, placing a new educational plaque titled, They Led the Way. The sign recognizes the men of the 135th USCT, who, as executive director of Civil War Trails, Drew Gruber puts it, entered town as formerly enslaved people and marched out as federal employees, soldiers, in the United States Army. It is wonderful that this story is now being told. Learn more about Civil War Trails using the link in the show notes. Now, click the remote, grab a handful of popcorn, and let's delve into some Untold Civil War. Welcome to the Untold Civil War, and we are at the movies again. I've done this before with Will Eichler, where we discussed some of the movies that he produced. We also did this with a good friend of the show, Michael Connors, of the Civil War Roundtable of New York, and we discussed Horse Soldiers with John Wayne. And today, I am with Ben Frail, commanding 2nd Rhode Island, reenacting Company B. He's also a very good friend of the show. You've probably heard him on here before. Huge history buff, and we're going to do the big one. We're discussing the movie Gettysburg.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be back, and always a pleasure to be here with you, Paul.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show and willing to take up this ginormous task, really, to discuss this movie. How long is the extended edition? Over 3 hours?
4 hours and 31 minutes, I think, according to Amazon. Yeah, as soon as they released it, I bought it, and I've been watching it almost every day since. So
it is an awesome movie, and you do have to see the director's cut / extended edition. It adds so much to the movie, I think.
Yeah, it does. Definitely does.
Couple things here that I wanted to get into. First of all, maybe to just talk about this movie, I was introduced to the Civil War through this movie. I mean, I think this is the movie that actually got me started and passionate about the Civil War. Is that the same for you?
Oh, definitely, without a doubt. You know, I think I said it in previous episodes that I've been on with you. My dad's a former Marine, so I wasn't watching your typical kids shows growing up. So at 6 years old, Gettysburg had just, not the year it came out, it was maybe a year old at that point, right on TNT, where we sat there and we watched it for the first time. And since then, you know, like you, like many other Civil War buffs, I was hooked. Yeah, it started a long road of me studying the war. And then eventually when I turned 14, you know, joining various organizations between reenacting and memorialization work. And I've been in those groups for over 20 years now. So
before the movie Gettysburg, there have been movies about the Civil War. After the movie Gettysburg, there have been movies about the Civil War. Mm-hmm. Why does this one stand out to you? And where can we rank this among other Civil War movies?
This one for me is the top. It's the top one on my list. You know, like I mentioned earlier, it is the one that got me into the hobby. Got me to fall in love with studying the Civil War. So to put it anywhere else, in my personal opinion, for that sentimental value, I just can't do it. That's the biggest reason. I feel like there's good give and take where it's okay. You're focusing on the Confederate side a little bit. You're focusing on the Union side a little bit. So it's not just one view or another. They take some historical liberties. Because, you know, it's Hollywood. Every movie or TV show or miniseries, if you will, takes some sort of creative liberty or Hollywood magic, if you will. And, you know, as long as you're doing it, you know, respectfully and with the right goal in mind, I don't see an issue with that. So, yeah, Gettysburg is the top. For me, the second one, and this, again, has a personal appeal to it, is Andersonville. And that's because my ancestor that served in the war was imprisoned at Andersonville after he was captured at the Battle of the Wilderness. So it does have a personal connection to me, and you know, it pulls at the emotional heartstrings a little bit, especially because the guys that were captured and sent to Andersonville were actually captured at the Battle of the Wilderness in the movie. So it hits twofold of the, you know, the emotional ties. And then third is Glory. You know, those are my top three. Glory is just so, yeah, again, they miss a few opportunities in my eyes. The biggest one being that they could have rewritten the characters a little bit so that Morgan Freeman's character, Rollins, could have been, I don't know, more Frederick Douglass's son, who was actually the Sergeant Major of the 54th for a little bit. So I feel like that was an opportunity missed. But besides that, it tells such a great story of the men of African descent went through to fight in the war, you know, to fight for their freedom.
Well, one thing I would like to add to that, and I know there's going to be comments about this saying, you know, why isn't Glory number one for us? Because I agree. I would say that Gettysburg is number one for me. But a couple things there. I think Glory does a very good job. It does a very good job of telling the soldier story.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I think if you are a reenactor, for example, and you watch that and you see those 8-frame tents and, you know, the story of the drills and mm-hmm. Sergeant Major Mulcahy, right?
Oh, yeah.
All of that stuff really does tell like the soldier's story.
Yes. And to the point where every reenacting sergeant I know has a Sergeant Mulcahy impression. Every single one. That's how amazing of a job that they did at Glory. But like I said, for purely sentimental reasons, I have to put Gettysburg and Andersonville above Glory. And you know, that is what it is, but you know, people can hate me, love me for it, whatever.
Well, one thing I would say or add to that is that Gettysburg, I feel, and I know that to most people hearing that a 4-hour long movie is approachable, they'll probably say I'm crazy, but I do think it's a little bit more approachable than Glory because it's got the big name characters in there.
Yes.
So when you watch that movie or you introduce that to somebody, they can sit there and go, well, you know, I've definitely heard of Robert E. Lee and I've heard of Gettysburg and I've heard of Meade. And so when you're watching that movie, you see those names that you recognize from history and it sort of just brings you in very gently. You know, there's not much research that has to go on in that, right? If you have maybe like some high school level history studies, you probably have heard the most of those names, right?
That are mentioned. exactly. And like you said, it's people can, I don't know if relate to it is the right word, but people can pull from their history lessons a lot easier. Whereas if you know someone who's never seen the movie Glory, if you say, oh, Fort Wagner, Robert Gould Shaw, how many of them are going to you know, how many school systems do go over who he was and what that battle was and the significance of that battle?
They should. You would want them to.
100%. 100%.
Do they? We don't know. I don't know. Right.
So, I mean, I remember, at least in my history book, the famous Fort Wagner painting with Shaw on the 54th climbing the ramparts and Shaw at the top clutching his chest because he just got shot. That famous painting. I vividly remember that in my history book in high school. But we really didn't get into the battle or the 54th at all. It was just like, oh, yeah, here, you know, here's the picture and let's move on. And part of that's just because of how much they've got to cram in to the curriculum these days with U.S. history. So,
right. And arguably, yes, Fort Wagner was definitely a very interesting battle to study. But as far as Gettysburg is concerned, even in its time, people knew that Gettysburg would be a sort of a major focal point of the war. Even newspapers wrote, one of my favorite quotes after the battle was, Waterloo eclipsed, how grand Gettysburg was.
Mm-hmm.
Although now I think many people are turning and recognizing Vicksburg for what it was as well.
Yes, there has been a massive push in the history community, and in my eyes, rightfully so, to get the story of Vicksburg out there and how important not just the siege, but the whole campaign was out there. Gettysburg was still important, but falls into the trap of you've got the majority of the media in the East. The information can get to New York, Philly, DC papers much faster than, you know, an update from Vicksburg. And it also has the Vicksburg also has an air quotes negative effect of it was a siege. It wasn't a grandiose battle. So, you know, what are you going to read about as a reader Are you going to read about, oh, day 30 of the Siege of Vicksburg? Or are you going to read, you know, day one of the Battle of Gettysburg? You know, what's going to catch your eye a little bit more as a reader and hook you in? And I feel like all those play into why, you know, for 160 years, people have felt that Gettysburg was the more crucial battle. But, they're, you know, in my eyes, they're equally important to the overall Union success.
And just to bring it back a little bit to the movie itself, for me to say that this is probably my top Civil War movie, I think is a big deal, because I actually was never really a Gettysburg Battle fanboy. I have to admit, my favorite people of the Civil War was General Grant. Mm-hmm. And my favorite regiment, of course, is the 79th New York, both of whom were not at the battle.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was never really into Gettysburg like that. But just because of what we mentioned, the sentimental value, the approachability of the movie,
yep,
you know, still takes first place. But you're a reenactor.
Yeah.
I've seen you in action at Remembrance Day. Your kit looks great. The guys in your unit look great in uniform.
Thank you. We take pride in that. We bust our butts to make sure that our gear is top notch and as air appropriate as possible.
As you're watching the movie Gettysburg, mm-hmm. and you're seeing the guys in uniform, they were all mostly reenactors. A lot, yes, of the
extras.
The extras, that's the word. The extras, yeah. Yes. What did you think about the uniforms? What did you think about the gear? Good and bad. Good, bad, and ugly.
So, I mean, the biggest thing is, filmed in the early 90s, there's been a big push, I want to say over the last 10 years or so, for reenactors to get really top quality kits. And what I mean by that is like the proper cut. If your unit's uniforms were hand-stitched, then it's hand-stitched. Or if it's a combination of machine stitch and hand stitch, it's that proper combination. Whereas there really wasn't that prior to that. There wasn't that big of a push, at least that I saw in the early days of the hobby, that were for me. You know, I got my first kits from what they would call mainstream sutlers. So when I watch it, that's what I see a lot of, are mainstream sutler kits. You got a few that you can tell are, you know, like Buford sack coat with the velvet collar on it, the black velvet collar on it. You can see that it's like, okay, that was one that was specially made for him. They had specs, tried to do it as accurately as possible. You've got the occasional, like the one that always sticks out to me is a little round top, where you've got the 15th and 47th Alabama going up against Vincent's Brigade and the 20th Maine. And you've got a guy who's got artillery trousers, and he's got the big thick artillery non-com stripe on his trousers. He's got, yep, you just pointed to your hat. He's got the red kepi on, and it's like, yeah, you're an artillerist that they just said, hey, we need bodies. Here's a rifle. Like, we know you know how to do it. And that, you know, only someone like me is going to catch that. Only a reenactor is going to catch that. Or someone who has prior military experience. Because guess what? The color of artillery is still red today. But again, that's a logistical thing. That's a, hey, we need bodies. That wasn't something that they completely ignored and said, hey, we're not going to do this. You can tell that they took care to get details right that they needed to get right. Core badges, which, you know, the 20th Maine had 1st Division 5th Corps, which is that red Maltese cross. In the first day's battle, when Reynolds gets killed, you see the 14th Brooklyn boys with the red dot, the red circle on their hats, 1st Division 1st Corps. The Shamrock for the second corps on the third day battle. You see things like that throughout that really give it that extra element of authenticity that someone like me, I love seeing.
I would add just real quick also what I thought was really good about the uniform, the scene where they meet the John Henry, quote unquote, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. you have that hospital steward show up with the half chevron, the hospital steward insignia, the green insignia on his sleeve. Mm-hmm. I thought that was also nice, yep, touch.
It is a great touch. Yeah, but they missed the line there because they referred to him as a surgeon, where he wasn't a surgeon. He's a hospital steward. And for those listeners that don't know, that'd be the equivalent of, you know, a medic today, a combat medic today, or a naval corpsman today. But again, it's things like that that if you're not studying the war, you're not going to catch those things. They're not things that they did on purpose. They're just small oversights.
Right. There's little things that you could nitpick, of course, in any movie. I think one thing I saw, kind of like you mentioned, the first day's fighting, before the infantry supposedly arrives, there's some, I guess, B-roll where they have the cavalry, Union cavalry shooting, and alongside them are infantrymen firing their rifles. And I caught that and I said, wait, the infantry isn't there yet. It's B-roll. They have to show that there's an engagement happening. They need actors in the field to show that there's a major battle happening, right? Exactly. So I get it. And like you said, if I'm not sitting there squinting, looking, is that an Enfield? Is that a Springfield rifle? Yeah. You know, you're not going to notice it.
Yeah, and there's one scene that, and I 100% understand why they did it. It's First Day's Battle, where there's a cavalry squad that's in skirmish line in front of the defensive line, and you hear the command squadron fall back. They start turning off and running, and then artillery shell goes off, and, you know, stuntman goes flying. Well, you can clearly tell he's a stuntman because all he has on is the carbine belt. He doesn't have an actual leather set for his cartridge box, his cap pouch, anything like that, because they knew, hey, you're going to get thrown through the air. We have to make this as safe as possible for you. But again, you remove yourself from the historic element and you say, okay, like, yeah, they kind of had to do that because you don't want this dude, you know, landing on the small of his back and the cartridge box going right into his spine, causing some type of damage there. You understand that. Yeah, but other than that, you know, those small little things, it's, you know, it'll be tough to find things where they were wrong. Even the stuff where, you know, the commands that they use, you see a lot of the, oh, by files left, by files right. The one scene where Spears is positioning the 20th Maine, and he says, battalion, by files into line. That's an actual term to get your unit from column of four into line of battle facing the proper way. There's three different ways to do it. There's battalion, regiment, company into line, or company on the right by file into line, and then just, you know, left flank, right flank, depending on which way you're facing. They're accurate terms to either Casey's or Hardy's with light infantry tactics books. Those are the really small details that they really do get right.
If you are listening to this episode, I take it that you are a fan of the movie Gettysburg too. Can't get enough of Gettysburg? Check out the link in the show notes for 1863 Designs. Plenty of Gettysburg movie theme stickers available for purchase. Use the code UNTOLD for 15% off. As the pro advertisers would say, that's big savings. Since you bring that up, one thing I want to ask about is the pointing swords. Is that a thing? I know that from the movie, you see the guys, officers try to guide the line with their swords. I don't know if that was a thing, but you know better than.
So when they're doing the by files right, by files left, no. But when the officer, so the First Day's Battle, you see the officer in line with his arm and the sword outstretched so that they get their dressings right. That is a thing because it is the officer's responsibility to make sure that the formation, the officers and the non-coms, I should say, their responsibility to make sure that the formation is right and is dressed properly, is not going to bow, or, you know, everyone is shoulder to shoulder and where they're supposed to be.
Another thing that I thought was interesting, and maybe you can add a little bit more because you're a reenactor. When I speak to many reenactors, and I ask them about knapsacks. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought, you know, knapsacks look pretty neat. I said, I wonder if I could just buy one and use it for camping, just in general, just to have something like that. And most reenactors, if the people could see your face right now, they look at me and like say, this is the worst thing to purchase. It's horrible.
So they put so much stress on your shoulders while you're wearing it. I wore mine for a 3-mile march, 4th of July parade in Bristol, Rhode Island, which is the longest continuous 4th of July celebration in the U.S. It's been happening since like 1792 or 1793. We marched in it, and I told the boys, I was like, hey, if you want to wear packs, wear packs. If you want to wear bedrolls, wear bedrolls. I wore my pack. A couple other people wore their packs. After 3 miles, the best feeling in the world was taking that pack off because it did not disperse the weight at all. It's all right there on the straps, on the shoulders. The guys who wore bedrolls were just like, yeah, like they could sit there, and if we had to halt because the parade halted, they could actually take the bedroll off and switch which shoulder it was on and kind of disperse the weight a little bit. And by the nature of it, a bedroll is not going to have it's not going to have as much weight as a knapsack. You can carry more personal gear in a knapsack than you can a bedroll, but you have that ability, like I said, to take it off, switch shoulders. So, okay, I'm going to give my right shoulder a break.
Well, the reason I brought it up was there are a couple scenes where you see Union soldiers marching with the knapsack. And I noticed that when they're marching with it, sometimes they're holding on to the chest straps and pulling it tight and marching like that. And I heard from reenactors that that sort of helps
it a little bit.
And I saw them doing it. And I was like, oh, wait, you know, that is a thing.
Yep. So it helps a little bit. The other thing that you can do, and you see a lot, is those straps are supposed to have J hooks on them that you can cross your chest and actually hook into the shoulder straps. And that'll help a little bit as well.
And I think you actually can see examples of it with soldiers actually wearing their kit in Ambro types, tin types, and they'll have that cross straps on like that.
Yeah, I've definitely seen photos of soldiers wearing their knapsacks like that. The other thing that you see the soldiers with the bedrolls, and they would be issued a knapsack. But one of two things happened. They either hated it and ditched it, or it broke, because those straps are only, you know, there's, depending on the maker, two or three rivets in there, and then stitched in. It's leather stitched into canvas. Not that well made. They had to make a lot of them quick. You know, good old U.S. government, let's do it to the lowest bidder. So a lot of guys, when the knapsack would break, would just be like, all right, turn it into a bedroll and I'll get everything I can in there. That means a lot. And then once the supply train catches up, that extra weight will go into the baggage train, so that way I don't have to carry it.
Well, it seems to me that we can definitely give a thumbs up to the costumes in the movie.
Yes.
You mentioned Spears, and I have to say, you know, great beard and great pipe. He looks great. But who are some of the other characters in the movie that you would like to mention that kind of touched your heart or you were impressed with?
Other characters or real life people that I want to, you know, give a shout out to, if you will. You know, everyone, you know, most people in the history community knows that Buster Kilrain wasn't a real person in the 20th Maine. From my understanding is that they needed someone to kind of show the enlisted men's mindset, because everyone else is an officer. Everyone else is either a colonel or a general, or you know, you've got Lieutenant Tom Chamberlain as a supporting character. But I really like the one scene that I really like the most is the interaction between Confederate prisoner and Tom Chamberlain. It really does show a different mindset that typical Confederate soldier had, and that there were people and men who enlisted in the Confederacy that they weren't fighting to preserve or not to preserve slavery. It was because their home was invaded. It was because they honestly believed about, you know, states' rights. But yeah, so you see that that mindset. You know, as a historian, I look at it as, okay, yeah, you're fighting for states' rights. What was the biggest states' right? Oh, the right to own slaves. So that's, you know, the biggest thing you have to tell yourself as a historian is can't look back with modern morals on how they were acting, how they were thinking. Because you do that, you're never going to understand why they decided to do what they did in that instant. You try to sit there today and say, oh yeah, 100 people from your town all enlisted in a regiment or to form a company. And you've got people who, you know, that joined that prior to joining never had a care for the military. Well, it's because their neighbors and the guys they grew up with joined. You do that today and it's just like, okay, like I could care less if my neighbor or my buddy joined. Like that's their choice. That's not my choice. But there was such a big, lack of better term, peer pressure that was into every, you know, people enlisting that they did things they normally wouldn't do. You know, you only understand that if you put yourself into thinking how they thought back then. And that's just, you know, countless examples throughout history of that, where you have to put yourself in their mindset. And that's really why I like that scene. It's because it forces you as the viewer to go into their mindset. Whether, you know, you use your modern morals to agree with it or not, that's up to the viewer. I feel like most people would not agree with it these days, but you know, that's the great thing about movies is they leave it up to you to kind of come to that conclusion on your own.
Right. And I think that scene is great because it does do a tribute to the famous photograph, right?
Yes.
Of the three prisoners. And so you have that little tableau in there, which is just awesome. Another part of that I wanted to mention is that you actually know the actor who portrayed that Confederate, right?
Yes, yes. So Trent Walker, we're friends through social media, and he's a really cool down-to-earth guy. I got to talk to him a little bit about not only his role in Gettysburg, but his role in Gods and Generals. And he's someone that's incredibly thankful for our community, those in our community that have supported him through the years. And, you know, like I said, very down to earth guy. And yeah, it's funny. I kind of probably kind of annoyed by it by now, but almost every single July 1st, I'm like, hey, happy anniversary of getting captured. but yeah, no, very, very, very cool guy.
Collector of fine Civil War relics. Have you checked out the Excelsior Brigade? The Excelsior Brigade deals in the best quality of Civil War items. Stone cold mint items, dare I say, museum grade. See what they have to offer and be the envy of all other relic collectors. Link in the show notes. Some other characters that I'd like to mention, I think Stephen Lang as Pickett, really well done. And he still does a lot in Gettysburg and in the community, right?
He had a book come out a couple of years ago. It was a history book called The Wheat Field that actually helps, proceeds actually help go to the Gettysburg Foundation. Looking at it right now, and it's a, looks like it's a children's book to help teach, you know, kids about the battle, you know, the conflict in the wheat field during the Battle of Gettysburg, which is amazing that he still gives back to this day. And that's probably the one person that if I could meet any of the actors, I would love to meet Stephen Lang in person and just, you know, sit down and have a conversation with him, because, you know, he did such a great job as Pickett, did such a great job as Stonewall Jackson in Gods and General, and, you know, continues to this day to give back to Gettysburg and the historic preservation that, you know, all of us who do this love and is so dear to our hearts.
And he also narrates the Gettysburg documentary, right? And I think that was also really well done, which had a lot of, I believe, aerial drone footage in there of the battlefield, which was really cool. One thing I also remember him for is he had a one-man show on stage where he actually read the interviews from the book. I believe it's called Beyond Glory. I read it as a kid, and I tore through that thing. It was a collection of interviews with Medal of Honor recipients.
Something I would be interested in.
Yeah, I think you might be able to find some of the recordings on YouTube, maybe. But he did an amazing job in that as well. So I definitely recommend that to anyone who's listening. Stephen Lang was good. What did you think about Chamberlain? I thought that was pretty solidly done. Daniels does a good job.
He does a great job as Chamberlain. You know, it's kind of ironic, I guess is the right word. I don't know if you've seen it, but he just did the, was it Finding Your Roots PBS series?
Oh, I didn't see that yet.
No. They sat down and they have, it's through Ancestry.com and PBS, and they do a deep dive on celebrities. Ancestry. He had an ancestor that served in a Michigan unit that was captured the first day of Gettysburg. So it's definitely, you know, like I said, I don't want to say funny, that's not the right word, but ironic that here he is 30 years prior that he's playing Colonel Chamberlain, that, you know, Medal of Honor recipient of the Battle of Gettysburg, and he finds out that his ancestor was a private that was captured on the first day. You know, full circle. It's really wild to hear stuff, you know, stories like that.
What about Fremantle? I always think that that's an interesting character to bring in, of course. And
yeah, so from my understanding of Fremantle was that he wasn't an official attaché. He actually took leave from the British Army because he was interested about the Civil War. But from my understanding was that him actually wearing the British uniform never would have happened and didn't happen, just because that would have started an international incident had he been captured. And yeah, so it's good to tell that story because we got the Civil War here in the United States, but there are foreign powers that are taking interest into this. Even though he was not official, I have a feeling that, you know, he went back and told his superiors some of what he saw, and they kind of took his information and was like, okay, We'll do with it what we may and go from there. So,
and Fremantle's diary, which is published, you can purchase it, is a fun read as well.
Yeah, that I have to get that one. I have not yet read it, and I would like to.
It's really fun. There are some rather outlandish stories in there. So, you know, you take it with a grain of salt, yeah. But it's definitely a fun read. Well, here's one that I wanted to ask you about, and I'm sure will upset some people, but Martin Sheen or Robert Duvall as Robert E. Lee?
I got to go with Robert Duvall. Sheen did a great job. He's a great actor. Don't get me wrong. But one, Duvall just had, he's got the natural Southern drawl. And two, through his mother's side, he's related to Robert E. Lee, which is absolutely amazing to me to be able to say, hey, the person who's portraying this man has skin in the game because it's his ancestor. Or at least if I were the actor, it would make me give that much more of a performance to make sure that my ancestor was portrayed properly.
Another thing, since we're talking about Confederate officers, A.P. Hill.
Yes.
A.P. Hill was played by Patrick Falsey,
mm-hmm.
who I've had on the show to talk about A.P. Hill. That is his role that he plays at several reenactments. And I think he does a fabulous job as well. Definitely want to give a tip of the hat to him as well. And he's been on the show and he's talked about a little bit behind the scenes of the movie. So if you want to listen to that, I'm definitely put a link to that interview in the show notes.
Thanks to you, I had the luxury of meeting him through a Zoom roundtable discussion. I didn't realize before your episode with him and the roundtable discussion that he is an actor that's also a Civil War buff. He started reenacting in, I believe it was a Tennessee Confederate unit, and people were just like, dude, you look like AP Hill. and he went with it. Not many people know that, you know, from the conversation that we had at that round table. Also, again, seems like a really great guy and very knowledgeable. Is definitely very, very knowledgeable in the Civil War and in acting in general, because he is a classically trained actor.
The most recent edition of Military Images magazine has just come out. The magazine contains several great articles and images. My favorite article was on the Colt's second model Dragoon revolver by Frank Graves. Subscribe using the link in the show notes and get access to this great mag. And of course, we got to mention Tom Berenger as a Longstreet there.
Yes.
That beard is iconic, I think.
The glorious fake beard of Tom Berenger. And it's funny because he too is such a great actor. If you've seen other works of his, whether it's The Substitute or Major League, or he can play such a wide array, and it really does show, you know, he's a master of his craft. But that beard, I think everyone in the history community knows how that beard is just like, yep, it's a weird one. It's not the best Hollywood beard.
Now, speaking about these actors who many of them were very diverse in what they can portray. I mean, like we said, to do Chamberlain, but then also to do Dumb and Dumber. I mean, that's very two different types of characters for sure. Mm-hmm. Longstreet. And of course, what was his name? He played in Platoon, right?
Yep. Right? One of the sergeants in Platoon. Yep.
Right. Very different characters. But there are some actors that when you put them in a movie, you want them to play. Yeah, they get typecasted, and honestly, you want them to play themselves. John Wayne, I felt John Wayne was one of those actors, right? That any time of a movie came out with John Wayne, I knew what I was getting because I wanted to watch John Wayne.
Yeah.
You know, the movie The Alamo with John Wayne. It was, you know, John Wayne at the Alamo. It was all about John Wayne. I think Sam Elliott there is one of those characters too. I think he does a great job playing Buford. But of course, I'm watching it because that's Sam Elliott, of course.
Yeah.
That does a good job.
So it was funny. Me and my buddy Joe, you know, he's another reenactor with me. We were watching the first day's battle when I first bought the director's cut. He's like, I can't understand anything he's saying. He's just mumbling and he went off on a tirade where it's just like, I can't understand him. Like, that's the one thing I hate. I can't understand him. I'm like, yeah, but you don't understand. It's Sam Elliott. Like, that's what he's known for. And, you know, he was big in the 80s and the early 90s for, that was his thing, that gravelly voice, that tougher than tough guy character. And he brings it too.
He looks like a cowboy. He's a cowboy.
And he brings it in his portrayal of Buford, where it's like, if you're riding with Sam Elliott as Buford, you're going to be confident that, you know, either we're going to win the day, or he's going to do everything in his power to make sure we win. You know, he just inspires that confidence.
And yes, maybe it is hard to understand him, But I gotta say, when you do, he's got some great lines in there.
He does.
Can we pick apart some of your favorite Buford lines?
Hands down, my favorite one is the men in top hats and gold watch fobs will gut their chests and say what a brave charge it was. That's my best Buford impression right there. Or my best, I should say, Sam Elliott impression. That one is hands down favorite one from the non-director's cut version. There is a line in the director's cut version that I just recently found that he goes and, you know, the mayor of Gettysburg is essentially giving him a hard time saying, what, you know, there's been Confederates here for days raiding everything. We, all of our, you know, town supplies and livestock are gone. And then him and I believe it's Colonel Gamble are riding away. Colonel Gamble gives a nice little, hey, don't worry about it, young miss. The cavalry's here, to one of the town ladies. And they're talking about it. And Buford, Sam Elliott says, you know, that's my problem with politicians. They're too fat and, you know, are too willing to send other people to die for their causes, or, you know, something along the lines of that. And it's one of those lines that it rings true today. It rings true for hundreds and thousands of years where diplomacy fails. And now you're going to sit there and because you and some other politician are butthurt about something, you're sending 18, 19, 20 year old men and women to go, you know, fight in this conflict. Whether that was, you know, something that they actually felt back then or was just something brought on from, you know, because Desert Storm was just happening around the time that Gettysburg came out, whether it's, you know, an ideology from the Desert Storm era, who knows, but it's definitely something that resonated with me.
And one thing I would say about that scene, I think it's a shame that it got cut because I actually get the feeling that Gettysburg is a town from that scene.
Yes.
Right. You actually see the locals. You see that they're being affected by the invasion, right, of the Confederates moving through the area. Original edition, I guess, before the director's edition, extended edition, you might even forget that Gettysburg is an actual living and breathing town because I don't think they show any interaction with the civilian populace.
Yeah. And you know, that leads me to another great one-liner that he had and another line that they cut that Reynolds had. But with Buford, it was telling the mayor, I advise you guys to take cover. The mayor's like, well, for how long? And Buford just says, well, till the shooting's done. And it's like, that's why you love Sam Elliott. That's a perfect line. Yeah, they unfortunately cut it. And they cut another one where when Reynolds finally rides up, you see Buford and his aide in the cupola finally find him. Well, one of the deleted scenes is the initial interaction when Buford comes down from the cupola. And while Buford's coming down, Reynolds is giving his aides orders. And one of the orders he gives is to a lieutenant, hey, go ride into town and tell everyone to take cover, especially the children. And you know, that was another one of those lines, one of those scenes where it's like you said, it drives home the fact that this isn't just farmland that they're fighting on. There's a town that they're fighting on. And unfortunately, they didn't have any town scenes of the retreat through the town or anything like that. But there were a couple of deleted scenes from that first day that really pushed that point home that, hey, like, this was a town. This was where people, civilians live. Unfortunately, an opportunity missed there in my eyes.
That's a great scene too. I think that Buford and Reynolds really did play well together in that scene. You know, the whole, you know, the devil's to pay. You know, can you hold? Yep. You know, I reckon we can. Yep. So great scene there. And I also wanted to add another mention to the tableau scene when Reynolds actually gets killed, how they have all those guys posing perfectly, and it's a painting.
So, and there's a lot of, you know, Easter eggs, if you will, like that. You know, you've got that one. Another one of the Easter eggs that I personally like is the Chamberlain running down the hill. Again, reminiscent of the famous painting of Chamberlain running down the hill. You know, things like that, they captured well in controlled chaos, because that's what, you know, a reenactment is. It's controlled chaos, and especially when you've got that many guys, that many rifles, because one thing that people don't understand is even though you're shooting blanks, these are still 60 to 90 grains worth of gunpowder that if you're close enough, it can hurt you. Those scenes where someone's getting shot point blank and you see the hole in the chest, I'm willing to bet that that's not special effects, that they put padding under that stuntman's jacket And that's the hole that the gunpowder made in the check, you know, especially with cannons. You know, you've got the scene where the Confederates are charging the artillery and Pickett's charge and point blank get blasted in the face. You know, that's the definition of controlled chaos, because that's something that you've got to have those trained professionals that are like, okay, we want to capture this, but we've got to do it properly where no one's going to get hurt. Probably an air cannon that was inside the cannon that just shot debris out at them wasn't actually gunpowder. Like, all right, we're going to load it with an air cannon, some dirt, you know, make sure it's sifted so there are no rocks in there, and then, you know, go with that. But I can only describe it as that, as controlled chaos, and a lot of fun though.
Well, another thing you mentioned, those Easter eggs.
Yes.
And a couple things that came to mind was, of course, the tribute to Killer Angels.
Yep.
Right. Mm-hmm. So when Buster Kilrain is talking to Chamberlain and he's giving mm-hmm. the speech, he mentions the Killer Angels, yep. which I actually don't think is in the book. I know he mentions Killer Angels in the book, that whole speech.
Yeah, it's not. While we were doing show prep for this, you and I, you know, skimmed through the book you skimmed through a PDF copy. I skimmed through my hard copy, and it's not mentioned in that soliloquy that Kilrain gives to Chamberlain. And it's also a lot darker in the book than it is in the movie. They definitely tone down the message a little bit, if you would. So,
but it's a nice tip of the hat to the book. And that's another thing we have mm-hmm. to add, was that the movie is based on the book. So mm-hmm. a lot of yes. times when people say, oh, well, why didn't they mention this? And they didn't cover this part of the battlefield, and they didn't yep. even cover this engagement. Right. Yep. Well, the book didn't either.
Exactly.
So it was based on the book.
Exactly. I mean, as a Rhode Islander, I want to sit there and say, Culp's Hill, General Greene, like, what the heck? You got such a great, you know, such a great story right there that you could have shown, that really rivals Chamberlain for keeping the flank on the left side. You've got Pappy Green on the right side that's doing the same thing under a lot worse odds. A lot of the units around him had gotten pulled out to support other areas that were getting attacked. They did entrench, but you know, it was hairy on Culp's Hill for a little bit, and by no means a sure, you know, a sure victory for the Union that they kind of imply and you just brush over in the movie. But like you said, it's because it's not covered in the book.
Another Easter egg I wanted to bring up, maybe you can even describe the scene for us, but the Butterfield lullaby.
So the famous scene where you've got Tom Chamberlain talking to the member of the Second Maine, one of the mutineers, Colonel Milad. That where he's going on, he's like, oh, you ever heard of Dan Butterfield? Oh, you know, always with a hooker. Oh, well, I don't know about that, but a thing for writing bugle calls. And they explain the whole, it's probably like a 20-30 second scene that carries on while he's explaining the bugle call that's, you know, for this air brigade, you and me. You hear that one, you know, the next one's for us. He explains the whole Dan Butterfield. And that's how they remember it, because they were the brigade commander. But the director's cut scene continues, and Tom Chamberlain's like, oh, have you ever heard of, you know, as you said, Butterfield's lullaby? And he's like, oh, Butterfield's lullaby, what's that? Dun, 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 and the beginning of Taps. And which, look it up, Dan Butterfield wrote Taps. And bugle call that Tom Chamberlain is singing when they pan back to Chamberlain and Kilrain in the director's cut is actually him finishing out Taps. It's not the Dan Butterfield one. So that's, again, another one that, I mean, I'm probably going to sit there about every single deleted scene and say, I should have kept it in, because for me, it's like, okay, what's another half hour to watch this movie? I could care less. But it definitely another one where it would have pulled at emotional heartstrings, because I know a lot of people, veterans, family members of veterans, that they get the goosebumps, they get tears in their eyes when they hear Taps. And to hear, you know, this is how Taps was written, this was when Taps was written, I feel like would have resonated with a lot of viewers, not just Civil War buffs. I honestly think that that's probably the biggest one for me that I wish they kept in.
Well, since we're on the topic of music, what about the soundtrack?
Oh, hands down the best soundtrack of any movie, any time, any genre. I mean, I've listened to that soundtrack while working out. I've listened to that soundtrack while doing yard work, while doing work. I mean, I can listen to that soundtrack any day of the week, twice on Sunday. It's absolutely a beautiful soundtrack.
I actually listen to it when I'm going and touring the Civil War, any Civil War battlefield, not just Gettysburg, but anytime I'm doing anything Civil War themed, even on a road trip down to one of these Civil War shows, I'll listen to the soundtrack.
It's definitely on the road trip playlist whenever going to, you know, whenever going to Gettysburg. It's played on the way there. It's played on the way back. And I just wish it was longer because, you know, it's a long drive from Rhode Island to Gettysburg. But yeah, it's amazing. I can't say enough good things about it.
Plans for Memorial Day? Are you a veteran who enjoys fishing, woodwork, and hiking trails? Would you like to spend your Memorial Day networking with other veterans almost entirely free of charge? Check out Polar in the link in the show notes, an organization dedicated to organizing such retreats to support our veterans. You gave plenty. Let us return the favor. You've mentioned several times about the extended edition, the director's cut.
Mm-hmm.
For someone who's sitting here saying, should I purchase it? Should I sit through the full 4 hours of this movie? What would you tell them? I mean, I think there are scenes in there that really do change up the movie. I think that they add a lot more background and it gives you a lot more understanding of the characters and the plot and the layout of the actual battle, I think.
Yeah, I completely agree with you 100%. Definitely get it. Worth the $13-$14, whatever it is on Amazon. Because like you said, it goes into more stories and tells a fuller story. You know, we've already covered how it goes and drives home the point that there's a town that they're fighting around. It goes into some other backgrounds. You know, it kind of hits on the, not completely, but a little bit on the mindset of why Richard Garnett, you know, had in his mind that he was going to ride a horse during Pickett's Charge. It doesn't tell the full story of that. The gist of it is that before Stonewall Jackson was killed at Chancellorsville, he questioned Dick Garnett's manhood and his bravery. And that was something that really stuck with Garnett. And there's a scene in the extended version. It was when Pickett and his brigade commanders first arrived to General Longstreet's headquarters. Longstreet says to Garnett, hey, I'm sorry I had to stick you with old Smelly George here, because they just stopped finishing talking about the cologne that Pickett had bought with his wife in Richmond. Garnett sits there and is like, you know, it goes from a joking tone to a very serious tone where Garnett essentially says, you know, sir, I'm very appreciative of this opportunity. And Longstreet right away says, let it go, Dick. Let it go, Dick. You're a great officer. You know, we're lucky to have you in this command, essentially. As well, you know, I'm obviously paraphrasing, but it's one of those cookie crumbs that someone, an inquisitive mind, could have sat there and been like, hey, let's do some digging as to why is Garnett saying that? Why is Garnett doing that and acting that way? And on top of it, Gettysburg was made before Gods and Generals. You could have very easily worked into the script of Gods and Generals Jackson calling Garnett out. You could have bam, full circle, 10 years later, now we know what that was about. But again, like I said earlier, I'm biased. I'm going to sit there and say they should have kept every single deleted scene. And I'm going to tell everyone to go ahead and buy the extended version, because you get to watch all those deleted scenes. And like you said, it makes for a much better story in my mind.
I think one of the big scenes that was cut, but you could see in the extended edition, is the scene right after the first day where they're talking about whether the Confederates have taken that hill.
When they've got Hill, Ewell, and Rhodes meeting with Lee, and they refer to it on the next day where Longstreet's like, oh, well, I spoke with General Ewell about your opinion of going around to the right. And, you know, I put air quotes in there because everyone knows, and anyone who's studied the battle knows, that's really something that's blown out of proportion, going around to the right.
And I think he actually tells him in that scene is, you know, you won a victory.
Yes.
You know, it's almost as if everyone's so concentrated on taking that hill that they seem to forget that first day was technically a Confederate victory.
Yes. And again, being a reenactor, you get to somewhat experience what these men were going through. I've tried to scale Culp's Hill in Brogans. It is not easy at all. Trying to do it while under fire, if I was Ewell or Rhodes or any one of those brigade or division commanders, I would have been barking up the chain of command, been like, we've got to get these orders changed. This is not, you know, we, you know, kind of like the AK-AK scene in the Pacific where, hey, we can't do these orders without sustaining unacceptable casualties. Because guess what? That's what happened. They took heavy casualties and they didn't end up succeeding. And yeah, had they taken the hill on the day of the first, it's a completely different battle. And to see that deleted scene, discuss that and go into what the movie believes and the filmmakers believe are Ewell's reasonings behind it. As we all know, that's one of the most debated decisions of the Battle of Gettysburg. Why didn't Ewell take the hill? Was it Lee's wording of the order, take the hill if tractable? Or, you know, had he left that last word out, then Ewell's like, all right, well, I'm going to take the hill.
If Stonewall was there, he would have taken the hill.
Yeah, if Stonewall was there. So that old argument, you know, it's good for barroom banter, but it's Stonewall was a great general in his own right, but he was flawed. And I feel as if that's not as well pushed. You know, you read accounts of the Peninsula campaign where he's coming from, you know, his Shenandoah Valley campaign of 62. There was, I forget how long it was, but essentially he didn't get sleep for like a week straight. And it went into his decision-making. And people, there's a really good article. I don't have the book with me. It's in one of the other rooms, but it's all articles about the battle, or not the battle, but the Peninsula campaign in general. And one of them is a nice article about how Stonewall messed up during that campaign. So that whole, oh, well, Stonewall is at Gettysburg. You never know. He wasn't perfect. Heck, the one breakthrough, this is something that I hate about guys and generals, is the one breakthrough of the Confederate line during Fredericksburg was in Jackson's part of the line. He completely underestimated the swamp area that the Union forces were just like, hey, we're going to go and exploit this. You know, it ends up turning into the slaughter pen at Fredericksburg. But had Union command exploited that, we're thinking of Stonewall Jackson completely differently today, because the Battle of Fredericksburg has potentially a different outcome. Is Jackson still in command of that corps because his line broke through there? You messed up at the Peninsula campaign. You messed up at Fredericksburg. People are completely thinking of him differently if that one little thing changes. And that's something that I don't think a lot of people, when they throw out the, well, if Jackson was there argument, they understand.
If anyone wants to actually see that ground, that battlefield, I do have a YouTube video out when I walk that battlefield. I'll definitely put a link to that in the show notes. So now, before we do the big rating of the movie, what our rating is, not that anyone cares about our rating or our review, but is there anything else you'd like to mention before we do that?
You know, bring it back to my top three of movies, and me being a Rhode Islander, there is some Rhode Island Easter eggs in all three, I guess I would say. In Gettysburg, the famous scene, I mentioned it earlier, where the Confederates are going up and get blasted away by a double canister. That's the position where Battery A, 1st Rhode Island Light Artillery, was. There's some debate on whether it was the Battery A or New York Battery, because the debate is, the Rhode Island Battery was out of ammo. So they pulled the whole battery out. I don't know how much of that is true or when the timeline of that was. I know that if you look at the monument on the battlefield, that right where that happened, right across from the 26th North Carolina Monument, maybe 20 yards from the stone wall, is Battery A, 1st Rhode Island Light Artillery's monument. So there's that. In Andersonville, unfortunately, one of the members of the Raiders in Andersonville was a member of a Rhode Island unit. And then in Glory, the artillery unit that is giving supporting fire prior to the 54th marching to storm Fort Wagner is the 3rd Rhode Island Heavy Artillery. So those were, you know, some Easter eggs that I thought as a Rhode Islander was pretty cool to see, even though you've got to be a nerd like me to know that those are actually Rhode Islanders.
I knew bringing you on that Rhode Island would have to get its time in the light there.
Oh yeah,
I knew that would be brought up at some point.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also, you and I talked about this last night. There is a very famous war relic from the Battle of Gettysburg at the Rhode Island State House in Providence. It's called the Gettysburg Gun. What ended up happening was this Battery B, 1st Rhode Island Light Artillery, they're lobbing shells back at the Confederates. Confederates are lobbing shells back at them, and one of the shells actually strikes the muzzle of one of the pieces, kills two of the gunners instantly, or one of them instantly, and another one mortally wounds, who dies shortly thereafter. And shameless plug, his Bible is actually at the Varnum Armory in East Greenwich, Rhode Island. They tried to reload the piece after it was struck, and they got a cannonball stuck in the muzzle, because the piece was struck, it dented the muzzle to the point where they couldn't get it in. You can see on the muzzle where they took axe heads and their implements and were trying to hammer the round shell down into the barrel, and they just couldn't get it in. You know, obviously that piece is now not serviceable. Brought it home to Rhode Island, where it became a war relic. Was in the State House, where about 100 years after the battle, someone in the State House said, you know, these are muzzle loading cannons. Ball is stuck in the tube. You got to put gunpowder in first. So they call in the National Guard, and they actually have to have the National Guard defuse the gunpowder that's in the tube, because there was gunpowder in the tube. And that was in like the 1960s. And it's been at the State House, I don't want to say ever since. There was one time where the boys of that Betray Battery B, currently the guy who runs it, his name's Phil DeMaria, they brought the gun back to Gettysburg for a weekend. You know, I wish I could have been there to see that, because that's one of those things where that's a once in a lifetime opportunity. And yeah, great Rhode Island themed to Gettysburg, or Rhode Island element to Gettysburg.
Want to explore the great military campaigns in history? Military Missives allows you to deep dive into a military campaign. Pick a campaign such as Sherman's Atlanta campaign, and each month you will receive one new battle map and two documents related to the operation. This makes a fantastic gift for any history buff. Use the code Untold Civil War, no spaces, to get 10% off.
For sure, if people want to hear more stories about Rhode Island and the Civil War, we do have our previous interview on the second Rhode Island. So I'll definitely put that in the show notes. But I guess we could do, you know, insert drum roll here and do our final rating. And I think we'll do something a little bit different. What I want to ask is for your final thoughts, your final rating. Let's give a rating to the original. And a rating for the extended edition director's cut.
So I pulled up Rotten Tomatoes score of Gettysburg, and they only gave it a 77. Rotten Tomato, you did wrong on this one. The audience score on Rotten Tomato is an 89. I'd probably give the pre-director's cut one, I'd probably give it a 91, 92. The director's cut extended edition, I'd probably bump that up to 94, 95. I definitely feel that those deleted scenes, you're only adding 17 minutes to the movie in total. And the little nuanced things that those deleted scenes add, in my mind, is well worth the 17 extra minutes. What about you? What's your score?
You know what? No, I think you got it pretty dang good. I think that I will sit here and I will sit in agreement. I think that was really, really well done, because I have to say, you know, Gettysburg is definitely my top Civil War movie so far. But if anyone wants to come out with more Civil War movies, yes, please do.
Yeah, definitely. We'll review them too.
I would love you know. And I'm definitely gonna have to have you back on to do another review of another movie. Whether it's going to be Andersonville or Glory. I also was thinking about The Great Locomotive Chase with Fess Parker, Disney's. Yep. That's a Civil War movie.
Yep, that's a good one.
I have to say that probably the behind-the-scenes making of, which you can see for free on YouTube, was better than the actual movie, I thought, which is kind of interesting. But, you know, we could get into that. So many other projects that we can do. So thank you so much for coming on the show and doing this with me and tackling this very daunting task. It was a little scary, but I'm glad we were able to do it.
But yeah, and you know, Paul, anytime, always a pleasure and always honored to be on the show.
Thank you for listening while you drove to work, ran on a treadmill, telling Longstreet you should have gone to the right, thumping your chest and saying what a brave charge it was, or whenever you listen to podcasts. Maybe you are trying to improve your overall Civil War impression. Need a core badge, ID disc, smoking pipe, reproduction pocket watch key? Look no further than the Badge Maker. Link in the show notes. Please don't forget to give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, if so inclined, and follow us on social media, Facebook and Instagram. Be safe, and catch you again on our next episode.